This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
We're going to spend some time looking at the art and science of biblical interpretation, if you want to put it that way. I like that, the art and science. Sort of an art and a science. We are book-centered people in the sense that we're readers. We hold a text to be pretty important, right? Scripture is the central thing in terms of authority, in terms of where we derive the basis for all the things we believe. It's the final arbiter for, you say this and he says this. Well, to what do we appeal? And so Christians have always been this way. That's why literacy has always followed the church, and the church has always been highly invested in literacy. A church has always known how important it is that people can read. And why? Because the primary, foremost revelation, the essential revelation, is in text form. And therefore, how do I get that? How do I get all the treasures it has? I have to read. Now, if one person can read, they can explain it. But how much better if everyone can read? But now reading is one thing, but don't you ever read something and say, oh good, I read it. But it doesn't do me a lot of good because I don't understand it. So, questions. How about these questions? So imagine you're talking to someone, you're having a conversation, and you're sharing whatever it is, you're trying to explain something. They may say to you, well, I appreciate your belief, I appreciate what you're saying, but I mean, after all, that's just your interpretation. That's your interpretation, sure. And after all, we all do have our own interpretations. I got mine, you got yours. I mean, there's so many. And maybe the implication there is that we can't really know whose interpretation is right. You just sort of go with one, maybe the one that feels best to you, or maybe one that is part of how you were raised, and that's just the end of the matter. How might I respond? So think about that. Just think about that issue, the person you might talk to who says, and believe me, you know this already, but with our study of so many different people, or just people you know, you name it, somebody can somehow defend it in some way using some scripture. We're good at this. And so, how can I know? So interpretation, it's a big deal. And is it just a matter of, well, that's just my interpretation, so I can't necessarily commit it. How about this too? I put this one at the bottom here as well. What about those who, your fellow believers, you know, who might say, hey, look, why do we need to go to all this trouble? I mean, why worry about this? We don't need to overthink this thing. I don't worry about all that stuff with an interpretation and this, that, and whatever. I just read it and do it. So we don't need to get into all this complicated stuff about interpretations and whatnot. Just read it and do it. Okay. So we'll come back to these questions. And we'll say a little more about how we might respond to these. But for now, just let that sort of rest a little bit on your brain, because you've heard these things before, no doubt. But in thinking about them now, what we're talking about here then has to do with something. And I'll read you a little something from Mark chapter 13. I don't know. It's not much to it. But it's just something to show you, just one little thing I think is interesting. There's a parenthetical thing in this verse. Do I have that verse? Oh, yeah, I got my cool hermeneutics thing. I'll come back to that in a second. Our slides are kind of like off the side there. But you see, I'm interested in this little parenthesis here. He says, and this is in the middle of a lot of things. Jesus is teaching them a lot of things about the end times. And some of them are kind of hard to follow. But he says to them, just kind of cutting right into the middle of it. Mark 13 and verse 14, he says, but when you see the abomination of desolations standing where he ought not to be, and look at this print, this little note here, let the reader understand then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. I'm interested in that because I think that's funny, kind of in those, you know, parentheses like that. Not that the parentheses were in the Greek, but I mean, it's sort of a, it seems like an insertion. Is this Mark's comment? You know, he's just sort of like putting that in there, like, hey, everyone, make sure you understand this. Well, maybe, but then I don't know, because Matthew chapter 24 has this same passage where he's saying these same things. And in Matthew 24, he also says that you have that same little parentheses. Let the reader understand. And in fact, there's a great book on this subject that they entitled, by two authors, they entitled it, Let the Reader Understand. They took it right from this little parentheses. So the idea is, a reader is supposed to understand. The scriptures are not just collections of little quips, sayings, incantations. They're not just magical word combos. They're not just words of therapy. Oh, I feel good when I read them. They may do some of those things. However, this is revealed truth. It's in words and sentences and combinations of sentences. It's meant to convey truth. And for the most part, we're meant to understand it. I say for the most part because I'll grant that there are sections and things that are sort of deep and mysterious, and they're hard to just get your mind entirely around. But by and large, the things that matter, there are plenty of things we are meant to just understand. And that requires reading. And this is why you saw the $2 word on the previous screen. Let's go back to the previous screen. It'll be trailing off, but you'll see most of it. Hermeneutics. There's an S at the end of it. Hermeneutics. Have you ever seen that word? You've heard it. You've seen it. Yeah, I met a guy named Herman, but not Hermeneutics. Hermeneutics. Herman who? Well, you know, in the book of Acts, when, Paul and, I can't remember if it was Barnabas or Silas, one of those duos with Paul, you know, when they went into one of these towns, these Greek-speaking towns, where they weren't talking mostly to Jews, and when they went into that town, the people, it's sort of a weird reaction, they didn't get this that often. But in this one particular place, and I don't remember where it is, the people were really impressed by them. They saw a miracle or something. They saw something wild, and then they heard the great, Paul doing this great proclamation. And they thought, remember what they did? They worshipped him. They worshipped him, but not as God, not as the God, because that's not who they understood to be God. Remember? Zeus, and it says, and Hermes. Hermes. Zeus I'm familiar with, but that other guy. So Hermes was the god of sort of interpretations of messages, and he was sort of considered eloquent. Well, Paul's the eloquent, educated speaker, so he must be Hermes. I give you that background to say this is where this idea of hermeneutics comes from. This is the notion of the capacity to interpret. So hermeneutics is simply interpretation of written material. Now, sometimes people apply it to other things too. People will sometimes apply it in general to just the interpretation of anything. So various forms of art, you could say hermeneutics of like a painting or whatever, you know, like, when they have those abstract pieces of art and some guy stands in front of it and says, to me, what it says, right? It's like the old joke about the one that's a white canvas and the guy's going, it's so profound. It's like the vast emptiness of life. And then the guy says, no, they just took the picture out for, to cleaning or whatever. It's just an empty frame. So you're reading too much into it. So you could do interpretation of a lot of things, but primarily hermeneutics is about the interpretation of texts or the written word. And of course, what makes it necessary to do this with written word? Well, because if something is written and the person who wrote it isn't in the room with you, or is no longer living, or lives far away, or what, then you can't say, hey, what'd you mean by that? So if you can't ask just right there in real time, hey, what'd you mean by that? And they can say more and more about it. And incidentally, even as they're speaking, you're doing some interpretation of their audible words, aren't you? You're still. But their text, you hope it's clear enough. Like when you get instruction manuals, right? You know, you bring that thing over from IKEA, and of course, stuff made overseas is could be real tricky. Why? Because it's in broken English, and it's like, who did they hire to write this thing? It's not clear. So I don't know how to interpret these strange, awkward sentences telling me which piece, what goes how, where, and how to rotate it and clockwise. You know, it's like, oh, it's not clear enough. But you're doing your best. You're trying to do some good hermeneutics on that instruction manual. We do it all the time. We do it with letters people write. Don't you sometimes read people's email or text and go, huh? I do that all the time. Because people text stuff real fast. And then they, you know, ask you, hey, and your kids are, you know, would you do this, do that? And you're like, yeah, I might be willing to do that, but I don't know what you're talking about. I can't make heads or tails.
Hey, autocorrect.
And autocorrect. Yeah, that's right. They're like, hey, would you grab that crocodile in the what? You probably meant something else. I don't think you meant crocodile.
You should be able to do it without the vowel. Understand.
Just like the Hebrews.
Hey, well, the vowel's usually pretty clear.
That makes, yeah, talk about, try that, and you'll find out that.
Got a new accounts payable system. They didn't have enough time to train everybody, so we just started doing it without any training.
Oh, that sounds risky to me. Because, again, interpretation. What is this? I mean, numbers need some interpretation too, I suppose. The where hermeneutics in the kind of in the most academic way is practiced is on, you know, literary works, great writings, and especially old ones, and most especially ancient ones. Well, guess what? Here we come together regularly, all the time, as do Christians around the world. And what do? We open up various books, books bound as one, a book of books, and all of which is ancient in its origin and time period. And we read from it so as to comprehend it and apply it to now, to us. Now that need, you got to make sure you're doing some decent interpretation with a thing like that. So we all do it. It's not a choice whether you do it. If you read anything, you do it. In fact, every bit of text, including, like I said, all text, including texts, because that's the, right? Texts, as in what's on your phone, you're interpreting them all. To even read them is to interpret them. And so this is what we're doing. So let's talk, I want to say a word about what we will be doing is looking at all kinds of principles. There's really a lot of interesting things to learn about. A lot of things we never thought of before. I never considered. Some of which you do already, because you know, you're a lifelong Bible reading person, raised in church. You already practice some of these things. You just maybe didn't think about it and didn't put a name to it. And then a few things that maybe we sometimes find ourselves doing that might not be the best way to do it. It's good to sort of have the discipline to be accurate in how we handle the word, as we'll see in one of the verses. But so we'll talk about the main goals of doing a good Bible interpretation, what the main goals are. But in saying what they are, I'll first tell you what they're not. It's important to be clear what is not the goal of good quality Bible interpretation. One goal, one non-goal, the goal is not to discover novelties. We're not going for uniqueness. Novelties are beloved in the world. Everyone loves novelties. Everyone has what they call, what's the word for it? It's neomania or something like that. Newest is best. Newest is always best. If it's new, it's great. But not in this sense. New is a red flag. New is bad. It's sort of like what C.S. Lewis said about morality and teachers of morality, people who teach moral, you know, ethics and moral. He said, you never expect a moral teacher to come along and teach you a bunch of things that are brand new. Because the main things, right and wrong, is as old as man. If it's new, he says only quacks teach new things. And you should be suspicious because Because morality is not like the sciences. Look, a guy could discover something new in the physical world. A new tool, a new instrument might help you. That's all about new things. But these things are not by definition, they're not the kinds of things where you're adding on. You know them. So when it comes then to interpreting the Bible, we're not trying to be novel. Beware the teacher where you say, "Wow, I never heard stuff like this when the Bible was taught. This guy finds all kinds of things I had no idea. I never heard it before." I mean, if you've never been around, then maybe everything's new. But if you're seasoned and you've been around, and wait a minute, hold on. Which is why there's wisdom in just the time and experience and exposure of seasoned Christians, because they have a good ear. Because they go, wait a minute, I've heard, if there's a well-known passage, someone who's 50 years in the faith will say, "I've heard probably 24 sermons on that passage and read, 25 devotions on that passage and heard 100 references to that passage, and I ain't never heard anything like that before." Does that automatically make it false? No, but it's not a good sign. It's not a good indicator, So that's not what we're doing. If it's one thing we saw in our study of all the different groups, it's that some of the people in history who came along, and some of these televangelists today, remember those guys? Oh, they come up with all kinds of new things. "Brother, let me tell you something new." And it's, you think, "Wow, you must be really in tune." And while I'm going, "No, wow, you must be a really devious, oily heretic, because you really concocted something brand new. It has no place. It does not belong." So we're not going for novelty here.
Revelation warns us of that.
For sure. "Don't be adding to this one," John said. Don't add. "I did the job here. I don't need your help later to add to this apocalypse." So that's one of our things that is not a goal. But here's another one I want to give you that's not the goal not a good indicator of a Bible teacher interpreter. Our goal is not to confuse or confound, or, since I like synonymous words, here's my favorite one, or obfuscate. I like to roller skate. I like to ice skate. But I don't do obfuscate. That's no good. Or to bewilder. Have you ever heard people teach and preach and you're just like, "Wow, it's so strange. I don't know what they're saying. Wow, I can't necessarily even..." It's like, woo, it's all over. It's like they wrap their words and wind them this way, that, and I can't necessarily put my finger on what the point is, but it sounds... We're not here to do some kind of strange poetry with it so that when we're done, you go, "That kind of sounded profound in some ways, but I'm not sure what he said." No, that's no good. Calvin said, "For some people, Bible teaching is the art of giving incomprehensible answers to insoluble problems." That's what some people think it is. But no, we strive for clarity. See, we're not doing that. That's not the goal. I think one of the philosophers, maybe Nietzsche, one of these guys, that said one time, if you hear the philosophers that don't really know what they're talking about, they just try to blind you with a lot of fancy sounding talk, because all they're doing is like it's a smokescreen to hide the fact that they really don't have any meaning to convey to you. And incidentally, I don't know if you've ever noticed, since I've spent a lot of years working kind of one of the worlds I've been in for a while is the academic world, where I kind of see the journals and the papers and people's CVs on. And you wouldn't believe just the inane nonsense that passes for profound articles and conference papers. Have you ever seen this? And are you aware that some people have actually infiltrated this and exposed it? There are some, and there are academics too. There's some academics who finally kind of got fed up with just how silly this is. So what they did is they made up nonsense papers with nonsense titles, and they got them peer approved for conferences, just to show that these guys, I didn't bring any examples, but I should have. But in other words, there's something wrong in the state of higher education in these areas where people are primarily just writing things and teaching things that nobody understands. And it's very questionable whether they do, because I'm suspicious as to whether it actually means anything. But what happens is some people want to belong to the club. So it's amazing the power of persuasion to make people want to belong, that they'll pretend to understand things that are nonsense. Oh, wow, yeah, oh.
The emperor has no clothes.
What's that?
The emperor has no clothes.
But people will pretend, oh, esteemed professor so-and-so, that paper you gave on the blah, 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 the blah, blah, the blah, 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 but, you know, it's like some long, convoluted title that no one really... Oh, it really was deep and it spoke to me. No, it didn't. You don't know what it means. He didn't know what it means. Nobody knows what it means. So obfuscation and just you know, stirring up the dust, that's not what we're about. You know? So, I mean, I say all the time, we should hold the bar high. We should go for it. Yes, sir?
How about it doesn't matter if you're factually correct? So
oh, stop.
Morally right.
Yeah. Oh boy. Yeah. I always send you your favorite. Yeah.
Q was pronounced quay.
What?
What Q was pronounced?
Oh, quay. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've been waiting in the quay so long to hear someone say that. No. It's just dumb. We don't need to be in that business. If people, like I said, I mean, I don't think we should dumb it down. I've kind of come against that sometimes, about the church just spoon-feeding people cotton candy all the time, and when we should, you know, people can handle a lot. People are smart. People can put deep roots down and understand. But that's very different from me, say, coming in here and ascending into the pulpit, and then just spilling a bunch of nonsense that sounds profound because I use a lot of big words and blah, 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 and then you leave going, wow, he sounds smart. I don't know what he's talking about. What good did that do you? You came to the table and watched somebody pretend to be a highfalutin chef, and you got nothing to eat. You see what I mean? You got no food. If you can't digest it, then what good is it? So I believe the church should offer meat, but for crying out loud, I mean, it should actually really be there. It shouldn't be the ethereal concept of the notion of meat that we all just, you know, meditate on for a while. No, it should actually be delivered and chewed and digested. Sorry, vegans. I'll put in parentheses, and soy. Oh, I'm kidding. What's that?
When she was at OU, the second year.
She basically asked the professor if she needed to dumb it down for
her. She told him she'd read it to him in third grade, and then she...
It's like giving a child a King James Version to read.
Yeah.
Yeah. Young man, whithersoever thou goest, thou shalt, you know. I mean, it's or I mentioned before the guy, the story I like to tell about the missionary the missionary I knew in St. Petersburg, you know, in Russia, mm-hmm. and came across the guy handing out King James Bibles on down to the front steps in the town square. He's like, "Why are you handing out King James Bibles? These people speak Russian. What are you doing?" He's like, "It's the only word of God." And it's like, oh, okay. So all of the good people of planet Earth, it shall be required of you. If you want entrance into the kingdom, you had better learn Elizabethan English. So I'm going to need like the peoples of Indochina to be Shakespearean in their education. Right? What? Yeah, that was real dumb. So we're not discovering novelties. We're also not trying to just cloud things up and make people think we're so erudite or whatever by confusing them. And here's another thing we're not out to do. Our goal is not to proof text for our favorite opinions or positions. Now, this is one of the most common things that happen in biblical study. People mine through the scriptures for ammo. Mm-hmm. That is, I got a way I see the world, the things I like to believe, how I think it is. I want them to be true. I like them. I live by them, whatever. And I'll be darned if I'm going to change my mind. So somewhere in here, I'll find the ammunition I need to, you know, put together some kind of biblical basis for it. And I don't care how creative and strange or whatever I have to be. And I don't care if some other people say, hey, you're just abusing that text. You can't mean that. They're just a bunch of, you know, Pharisees trying to control me. Now, this is so common. This is so common. It's in all of our nature to do this, by the way. I mean, look, proof texting is something we all want to do, right? I mean, it doesn't always come from a bad place. I mean, I want to do it a lot. I'll often think, ooh, how can I show, you know, I'm pretty sure that's a true understanding of that. Which verses say it, you know? Or that whole question people ask, doesn't it say somewhere, you know? Hey, doesn't it say somewhere that I sure hope it does? I'd like it to. If it doesn't, it should. You know, it's like...
I'd like to know where people came up with the rapture before the tribulation.
Oh, don't be
it's
open
nowhere in the Bible.
Keep that can of worms closed, thank you very much. Please. What are you trying to do to me up here? Gonna open up that one. Speaking of hermeneutical challenges, open to Revelation, please. Yeah. Look, as we will cover in later weeks, the Bible is an interesting variation of different styles, different writers, and different styles. So not every kind of writing is the same kind of writing. Here's a song here, here's a poem here, here's a straight ahead text here, here's a genealogy there, and in a few places, here is a wild, far-flung vision of the future. And that last one is notoriously difficult when it comes to interpreting. It really is. Hey, you know, you give me Philippians, piece of cake. There'll be a few things in Philippians that'll challenge us, but I'm just saying, by and large, it's pretty straightforward. Now, you show me the middle of Ezekiel, different story.
You give up when you're going to Revelation.
I know you, of all people, would love that, wouldn't you? You would love that. Now, Harold's memorized parts of it. So, you know, maybe he's the man to handle that task. I almost feel like something like Revelation, I want to do the four views thing, like those books you buy, because it's so notoriously difficult to know exactly. It's like seven bowls of judgment. Whoa, boy, here we go. By the way, you know how many bowls of... Wheaties it would take to equal seven bowls of judgment. I'm just kidding. That old commercial, it would take this many bowls. Yeah. I knew you'd laugh at that. So what are we to do then, people? We're not just proof texting. We're not just looking to the Bible for some way to justify what we believe. So what are our goals? I'm glad that you asked. So I do have a slide that shows what our goals are. Of course, the father-son team back there is having a disciplinary moment. So, or perhaps, I don't know. I don't want to assume too much. Or a moment of guidance, or a tender moment. Yes, John.
As you're talking, there's a passage in 2 Peter 1, and it just works.
Anybody else have that experience?
Mm-hmm. Verses I memorized when I was a child that basically had very little meaning to me, because all there was the King James Version.
Right. So in a way, the way that it's like other books is that it is words and it is on a page and you do have to interpret and understand it. But it's not like other books, and it's far more. So it can have layers of meaning. It's living and active, you know. It can speak to a circumstance. So the slide that has our goals is just I just put four of them on there. If Jeremy's awake, he might show us what that is, but. Is this simple enough for you? Accuracy, clarity, honesty, faithfulness. I could say more. We could expand those, but that's simple enough. So instead of I'm trying to confuse people, I'm trying to make stuff up, I'm trying to be novel, and I'm trying to proof text with my own personal opinions, then I'm trying to be accurate. I want to know, what does this actually mean? And incidentally, something we'll talk about later. It's a question to hang on to. Can it mean for me something it never, ever, ever meant before? It can apply to me maybe in a unique way, but can it actually mean something that it didn't mean before? Or can it mean the opposite of what the writer intended? This has a parallel, by the way, with how we look at other texts. How you look at this text is similar to how some people look at, for example, a text like the Constitution. There's a real divide among people today about that as well. How do we interpret that? Does it matter what they meant? Or is it just like what I feel that it means to me personally? How dynamic is it? How elastic is it? You know, is it a living document in the sense that it can mean the opposite that it once meant? If we take that approach to the Bible, might say, oh yeah, it said don't worship idols then, but to me today what that means is worship a lot of idols. That's just my interpretation. So my interpretation is now the opposite. See, that sounds extreme, but you know, we're just trying to be clear about it. Some people really try to cool the Bible up, like, I got to make this as cool as possible. Please, focus most on making it clear, okay? If it's cool, it'll be cool. And if not, so much the worse. Who cares? Just make it clear, for crying out loud. Because sometimes your attempt to make it oh so relevant, you kind of butcher it up while trying too hard to make it relevant. And just be honest with it, you know. And that sometimes means that maybe I discover something that kind of goes against something that was a sacred cow for me. But if I'm honest, I'll go ahead and say, well, maybe I like that view, but maybe I'm wrong. Because I'm not the final authority. If I have my views ahead of time and then I come to the Bible and I mine it for proof text, then who's the real authority here? Mm-hmm. Me. And I'm saying, okay, different writers and different books, line up behind me. And what you say that I like, I will take. And what you say I don't care for, I'll leave it. Leave it alone. So then finally, let me just show you my last thing here. The answers to those questions. I asked you the question. So what would you say? Someone says, that's just your interpretation. Well, I think a good answer is to say, yes, it is my interpretation. Now, by saying it's just, sort of seems like you're trying to kind of like belittle it a little bit, like it's just, like it doesn't mean anything. But it is my interpretation, obviously. So what? Obviously it's my interpretation, I'm telling it. But the question is my interpretation any good? And why? That's not what matters. We all have our own interpretations. Oh, of course we do. But so what? What of that? Are you implying they're all correct? That's impossible. That's logically impossible. Because if they're at odds with each other, someone's got to be wrong. Are they all wrong? They could be. Not necessarily, but they could be. Does that mean it's totally subjective? It's just each one of you is like, you like country music, you like jazz, you like this. So you like this interpretation and you like that. We're not choosing ice cream flavors here. There is objective truth to it. What if people treated your letters that way? What if you wrote something? What if you wrote some heartfelt letter to all the people in your life and you handed it out and they all just chose to make it mean what they like? It's like, wait a minute. No. I meant something there. I had an original intent. So, yeah, we all have our interpretations. But again, the real question is it any good? Is it accurate? Does it reflect the truth? And then for those well-meaning Christians who say, well, I don't worry about no fancy interpretation. I just read it and obey. Obey what exactly? So you see, whatever you're trying to obey, you've understood it to mean something. You're assuming some kind of meaning. So even when you read, just to read is to interpret. Reading is the most basic, fundamental, first level of interpretation, because you're looking at words and you're understanding what they mean. You think, haven't you ever had a word in a sentence and you read it, but you don't know what that, you think it means something it doesn't mean, like the word, you're not familiar with it, and you assumed it meant one thing, and you get the whole thing wrong, because it's like, oh, I thought that word meant to, to bless. In fact, it meant to slap, you know, and so like, does that change every time it appears? Yeah, so even reading is an interpreting, you know, every word, you're hoping you understand it right. So all of this hopefully is simply to make us more, to make us truly faithful in this way. So 1 Timothy 2:15, do your best, this is the ESV, to present yourself to God as one approved. A lot of translations will say things like, be diligent. And the old King James says, study to show yourself approved. A worker who need not be ashamed, but who rightly handles or divides the word of truth. That's what we're going for, right? So be diligent, study. Apparently, rightly dividing the word, rightly handling the word, it means putting in some work. Because why else would it say, you got to be diligent, you got to do your best? It's implying I got to work. And nobody likes to have to work hard. But it's a funny thing about life. All the best things and most rewarding things, turns out, require a little work. And then in the end, you're glad because it pays off, right? So and that lesson applies here to biblical interpretation. If we really put in the work, we kind of get better at it and better at it and make it a discipline, then we can be closer and closer. I'm not saying you get to some point in life where you say, I now have mastered everything in the Bible. I understand it all perfectly. And my interpretation is 100% right. No, because you have not achieved omniscience. You don't know it all. So don't be a know-it-all, because you don't know it all. But you can at least be, throughout the course of life, be getting closer. What do they call that? An asymptote? Isn't that what that is? And you're like, woo, you get closer and closer and closer. Like at school when they told you, the line gets closer and closer to the axis, but never crosses. When I was a kid, I was like, no, 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 wait a minute. That's impossible. It has to cross sometime. Math teacher said, shut up, kid, or I will flunk you now. So I was like, all right. But, you know, that's the idea. You get closer and closer throughout your life, hopefully. You're getting closer to that holy grail of perfect understanding or perfect interpretation. You will never get there because you will, you know, you're going to be flawed. Your mind is paid to break to you. A feeble wreck of an instrument. That's all.